Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Hi, everyone. I'm Vanessa Richardson. I'm the co-chair of programming at Inforum here at the Commonwealth Club, and I want to welcome you to tonight's event. The topic tonight is urban etiquette and whether manners and civility still exist and matter in the 21st century. And this is yet another panel event that was brainstormed and shaped by Inforum's Super Programming Committee. And I want to especially thank Matteo Medrano and Julia Dunbar for their help in putting it together. We have a great panel for you tonight. From my left, Laura Lewis, Trish McDermott, Charles Purdy, and Jeff Sherman, and our moderator, Paul Wilner. So please give them a hand for being here. And I just also wanted to extend a special thanks to Trish McDermott for agreeing to be on this panel. She just gave birth a couple of weeks ago to a baby girl. So Inforum is putting on a lot of great events here at the Commonwealth Club. If you're not aware, it's a division of the club by and for people in their 20s and 30s. And if you join, you receive discounts to all club events. On November 15th, which is this Wednesday, we'll celebrate the 50th anniversary of Allen Ginsberg's epic poem, Powell. And then on November 30th, we're hosting a panel on online personas with MySpace, Facebook, and other companies to talk about how people are defining themselves in the rapidly expanding virtual world. We're recording this program for radio broadcast, so please take a moment to turn off your cell phone. And make sure to use the mic, which is in this aisle, during the Q&A portion of tonight's broadcast, so your comments are picked up on radio. Our moderator tonight is Paul Wilner, the style editor for the San Francisco Chronicle. So please welcome Paul to the stage as he kicks off tonight's program for the broadcast.
Thanks, Vanessa, and thanks to the rest of you for coming out on this dark and stormy night. I really had no idea I'd be standing up here. I know the rest of you are, but when some people are great at a cocktail party, but I usually find the most convenient sofa or couch to armchair to sit down in, so we'll do our best. We certainly have a great panel here. Bear with me for a second, please. Daryl Hannah, the movie actress, is in the next room, I gather, so I really certainly appreciate your choosing us over Daryl Hannah. You used to cover the environment, so I'd be interested in her remarks, too. I want to welcome you to tonight's meeting of Inforum. It's a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s. Who's the targeted demographic, I guess. As they say in MySpace or the television industry, with a mission to inspire debate around civic issues. Tonight we'll be talking about urban etiquette, manners and civility in the 21st century. And it sort of raises questions about whether or not these sorts of moral and ethical questions are in disrepute or whether or not this is something that people have been thinking about for time immemorial, and I'll be curious what our distinguished panel here has to say on that subject. I have to say I got here a little early and on perhaps related subjects and dropped by Stacy's bookstore downstairs, and I noticed that they had an interesting sign that said, "Please subdue your cell phones in this bookstore." So I kind of like the use of the term subdue as a... You know, not too long ago, my wife and I went to a screening of Brokeback Mountain, and in one of the many different poignant scenes in that movie, we were sitting at the Sequoia Theater in Mill Valley, someone's cell went off and you heard those musical tones, and it sort of disrupted the mood. Then it happened again and again, and people were getting understandably irate about it. Another sort of question I just sort of wanted to throw out there, just mention in passing, and Chronicle columnist Leah Garchick, who writes a popular and excellent column for the datebook section of the Chronicle where I work today, she says the following. This was her second item. The tale is told that before last Monday's show in Oakland, Mick Jagger stopped by at Van Morrison's trailer to see him. An aide went inside to tell Morrison that Jagger was there, and Morrison told him to say he was napping. Later, during the show, Jagger's emissaries went to Morrison's trailer to ask if he'd sit in and play with the Stones, but he'd already returned to his hotel. So I don't know whether or not that qualifies as poor manners or perhaps some karmic retribution for Mr. Jagger for impolite sins he may have committed in the past, but I'd be interested to hear the views of the panel and the rest of you folks. We'll have a Q&A later on about that. In any case, I think that the question before the group is urban etiquette an oxymoron, or are manners and etiquette simply changing and evolving along with technology and societal mores? And let me introduce our panelists without further ado. Laura Lewis, to my immediate left, teaches a business etiquette seminar at Stanford's Graduate School of Business, and she also teaches communication, presentation, and listening schools to various businesses in Silicon Valley, including Cisco Systems. Hi, Laura. To her immediate left is Trish McDermott, and as Vanessa pointed out, we owe a special debt of thanks to Trish for coming out, not just with the weather, but with a newborn baby girl in her life. She's currently the VP, Vice President of Love and the Chief Matchmaker. Great title. Great titles both of Engage.com, a new online relationship community, is a 16-year veteran of the dating industry, and it was part of the team that founded Match.com, has taught a dating class, and has written dating advice columns for both Match.com and MSN.com. To Trish's left is Charles Purdy, known to many of you as Mr. Social Grace, until recently a advice columnist for the San Francisco Weekly, where we both worked with, he worked with my former colleague at the Chronicle, Laurel Wellman, when she was doing the Dog Bites column there, and he currently writes a column for PlanetOut.com. He's also author of the book Urban Etiquette, Marvelous Manners for the Modern Metropolis, and from Wildcat Press, and I just want you to know, since we believe in supporting authors, that a signed edition is available at the local Cody's. And, you know, perhaps Charles can also give us insight into why it is, he's recently moved back to Vancouver, he was saying, why it is that Canadians are so inherently better bred than the rest of us. To Charles's left is Jeff Sherman, who's a professor of psychology, who also we owe a debt of gratitude to for making the rather long trek from the University of California at Davis. Jeff is also editor of the research journal Social Cognition, and much of his research focuses on how people perceive themselves and how they perceive other people, which is not always the same thing. So I thought perhaps we would begin with the with Laura, and you know, by all means, cut me off any time. I'd be much more interested in what you folks have to say, because you have more expertise than me. But in the business etiquette field, you know, how much more important is the knowledge of etiquette in a business setting now that men and women are both in the workforce? I think Charles has something in his book about what whether or not it's permissible to say you look nice to a young woman when you're or a middle-aged woman, or an older woman, when you see them at the office, you know. Is that acceptable? How different is that from the past, when in a male-dominated workplace, the office could be a very locker-room-like environment with no regard for female sensibilities? Is it an accepted fact of business life that people will promise to call a client, vendor, colleague, and fail to do so? Is this different than the past? Perhaps not all that different from people who promise to call us socially and don't quite get around to it, but I guess there are economic consequences. Has the movement to technology away from face-to-face interactions led to a loss of civility? If anyone who's been flamed, probably no one in this group, might have some views on that. And has the prevalence of email led to better grammar and critical thinking skills, or the opposite? So a number of different subjects, but perhaps you could address the ones that you see fit.
If I could remember the ones you've just rattled off, Paul, I would. And let me just say that as a middle-aged woman, if a young man gives me a compliment, in the workplace, I'm always flattered to hear that. But having said that, times have changed. I was born in 1950 and raised in the Midwest. My father was from the South, and so I was raised with a very set of morals and rules of etiquette. And as an instructor in the workplace for the last 19 years, I've found that those rules have certainly changed, and in large part because there are so many women in the workplace now, which is a wonderful thing. But it certainly has blurred the lines between what's appropriate and what's inappropriate. And that also differs depending on where you are in the United States. If we're looking just at the national landscape, we won't go into international etiquette tonight, but within the United States, there are differences. If you're doing business on the West Coast, that's very different than doing business in the South or in the Northeast or in the Midwest, for that matter. And so tonight, for instance, when we walked into the room, Paul stood aside and made way for Trish and me to pass in front of him so that we could enter the room first. Well, as a girl growing up and as a young woman, I was raised to believe that was the correct thing to do. But in New York, for instance, in New York City, if that were to happen, there are women who would take umbrage at that and would say, you know, what's with this? You got there first. You go ahead. And so there are fine lines.
Well, just on this regional difference question, are the Midwesterners more polite, speaking as a Midwesterner? I did see a thing on the Times not too long ago that suggested, of course it was in the Times, and they suggested that the New Yorkers, I'm an ex-New Yorker, were the most polite group in the country, but it might have been skewed by the... Well, seriously, do you find the Midwest folks more polite, given cultural differences or experience attitudes than other parts of the country?
Well, I hate to use strong generalizations, but I would say that my experience is that certain parts of the country move at a faster pace. The coasts, for instance,
indeed,
tend to. And I think the central part of the United States does not move at that same pace, mm-hmm. and therefore it allows more time for conversation, for listening, for what Emerson called the happy way of doing things, which is what manners are. And so I do see a regional difference in that.
Does that go so far as to a blue state, red state? I mean, there are some.
I could get into trouble here.
There are some.
I'm going to pass that.
I must say that even though we're here, there are some quite polite Republicans, I'm told.
Depends who
I've
you
heard
are.
That too, Paul. Okay. I've heard that too.
What about, since you're teaching at Stanford, what is the differences that you've noticed since you first got into this field? Certainly, we're talking about the speed of change in the society, mm-hmm. and technology has been driving a lot of that. Are people forgetting their P's and Q's as they're instantaneously commuting, text messaging, instant messaging, cell phoning, or is...
I don't think there's any doubt that technology has impacted the social setting as it has the business setting in terms of social interaction. And I think a large part of that has to do with multitasking, which I think is in a way sort of a euphemism for ADD, because
right.
I think people have become so absorbed in occupying different spaces at the same time that it's very hard, especially for my children's generation. Mm-hmm. I have a 24 and a 27-year-old. It's very hard for them to turn off a cell phone, to turn off a Crackberry, to let go of the electronic leashes and say, I'm in the moment. I'm listening to you. Mm. And you are the most important person in this moment to convey that message. Because they might be missing something. There's something else going on out there. There's some new stream of information that could be more interesting. And I think that has impacted students. I think it's impacted young professionals. And to that degree then impacted the people that they work for. Because as middle-aged employers and hiring staff that creates a certain dissonance, that technology gap.
So it's experience as rudeness.
Yes. And the interesting thing in terms of what I see at Stanford or the people coming through Cisco is that in that culture, it isn't experienced as rudeness. It's experienced as the norm. It's accepted. And so there is this disparity between what that peer group accepts as
right.
polite behavior and
right.
what is experienced outside of that peer group.
Well, it's funny. I was watching Prime Suspect last night, and there was a murder witness who Helen Mirren was having trouble getting her attention because she was text messaging her girlfriends at the same time. They were trying to find out who killed the young girl in the plot. Well, you know, another example of why the Luddites perhaps were right. Trish, we moved on to from incivility in the workplace. Perhaps we could move into an even more intimate sphere of how people are negotiating this in relationships.
Well, I think that dating has changed a lot, although fundamentally the desires and interests that we bring to dating and romance are the same as our parents and our grandparents brought. I do think, though, that the fairy tale is somewhat over in terms of romance. And if you think of how many little girls learned about romance, you know, we read all of these lovely little fairy tales where girls were somewhat passive, we might say. If you think of Sleeping Beauty, she was basically in a coma. And waiting, although very lovely in her coma, of course, and waiting for her prince to come get her. And she had to do very little. In fact, she did nothing. We were lucky that she was breathing. And yet she lived happily ever after. But, you know, we now don't live in that same society. And I think that several things are going on that are really impacting dating. And one is just the gender confusion around what is right and appropriate in terms of going on a date. And, you know, for instance, while it is still generally expected that men will pay for the first date, there are a lot of women who feel that there may be an insult or an expectation tied in with that payment. And so they feel that they'd actually like to pay for the date or go Dutch or pay for the entertainment portion of the date. So poor men, you have to really feel for them because they're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place, because if they pay for the date, as their father or grandfather might have taught them to do and was socially acceptable 20 or 30 years ago, they might somehow be inferring that a woman doesn't earn the same amount of income that they earn, or isn't capable of paying her own way, or isn't somehow equal in terms of how she comes to the date. And the same is true for, like, holding the door, holding the car door. It's a confusing time for men especially, and I think it's helpful for women to sometimes speak up and let men know that it's okay. That having been said, you know, women will say, I really like the opportunity to pay for a date or to go Dutch, but, you know, then they'll whisper to their friend, that guy made me pay for that date.
Right.
There is no second date when that happens, guys, so you have to pay for the date.
Do they want Tom Hanks or do they want Clint Eastwood? You know?
So there's the gender confusion, right? We're not living in this fairy tale world. Women are very empowered. Women... The same thing that really that's going on in the workplace. Sometimes men will complain that women approach a date like it's a business encounter. It's an interview. They have criteria and logistics and strategy.
Uh-huh.
They're all buttoned up. You know, where's the flirtation? Where's the sexiness? Where's the place where we're just relaxing and we're people? There's not an agenda. There's not a goal in sight. We're just getting to know someone. The other thing I think that's really making dating confusing and influencing the way we act and behave on dates is the influence of technology. And, you know, if you look at Match.com, it's a site that, you know, I worked on for many years, has 15 million members, and like many of the traditional dating sites out there, you're expected to date in a social vacuum. There are no checks and balances around any of your behavior. You can lie, cheat, steal. In fact, you're rewarded for being better than you actually are on paper, right? For making more money or being thinner or more worldly or having a greater life experience, because it's a marketplace, and so you sell yourself. And so the fact that people are flocking, millions and millions of people, to these dating services where it's okay for you to exaggerate about who you are. It's not okay for the person you're dating to exaggerate. It's okay for you.
Right.
And where that behavior leads to at least more first dates. Now, I think if you talk to married people in this country and you ask them, what is the real quality or attribute that attracted you to your partner, most of them will say something like quality of character, decency, honesty, kindness, integrity. We don't see a lot of that actually happening on online dating services. Not a commercial for my company, but we sat together and said, look, there needs to be some sort of social experience when one is dating online, because anyone who has children knows that consequences is how, that's how we teach good behavior. You know, young man, there is a consequence for biting your brother on the arm, and the consequence is no dessert or no something that you like. On online dating services, it's generally the opposite. The consequence for bad behavior is more activity. And so we've tried to build a service now at Engage that just encourages people to be more socially participatory in the dating experience. People have reputations and people have an expectation that you will behave appropriately. The last thing I would just say is that I think it's sometimes really hard to get it right for single people. There are 90 million single people in the U.S. right now, and I think 89 million of them are really confused, and the other million have given up. And in the end, you know, and people ask me a lot, you know, what's the appropriate thing to say on a first date, or how do I behave in this particular situation? And I think that we have to leave the technology and we have to leave the gender confusion about what our roles are behind us and just go back to being people who don't necessarily say the most strategic thing or might not necessarily bring the best attributes to our date, but who are just real and genuine and likable. And what is generally so charming and ultimately attractive about people is all of that stuff on the inside. And most of us make mistakes in social romantic situations. We don't get it right. I'm sure, you know, I just had a baby. I don't even know what I'm saying right now. I'm sure I'm making a few
mistakes.
You're
doing fine.
Thank you. But beyond sort of the confusion of how to behave, if we can just be ourselves and be good, decent people, I think that we'll do well as we're dating. Did I even answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's another word for the first part of what you were describing of people's behavior, and I think it used to be called lying. And I think it's not uncommon perception, particularly speaking of gender differences, that it was sort of expected of men. I'm sort of curious of, maybe circle back at this later, what the groups of the panel of whether or not technology has leveled the playing field and now it's possible for women to misrepresent themselves online with the same dexterity with which men have been doing it for generations. Charles, my friend, one thing that I've always been curious about, your Mr. Social Grace, and in a time which is perhaps not most noted for it, how on earth did you begin to write a Social Grace column in the alternative press, which is not another arena that's not most famous for being a forum for those questions, apart from the personal ads, of course?
Well, I disagree that these are not socially graceful times, or that the alternative press or our alternative press readers are not interested in manners and etiquette. I'm interested in manners and etiquette because they are the language that we use to interact with other people, and what could be more interesting than other people? That's what everyone is most interested in. I think that I agree with something Laura said earlier, and that is not that we are less polite today, or that there are differences in how polite one region is more polite than another, or this time is more polite than that time, but that there are different kinds of polite and different kinds of manners. And we are not more or less polite today. I think it's very short-sighted to say that modern people are ruder than they were in the 1950s or the 1890s. I think that manners simply change, just like fashion changes and language changes. And what's more, etiquette is supposed to change with the time. Society changes. Etiquette rules have to change to keep up with them. And every year or so, they do some sort of poll where they ask people, is society ruder than it ever has been before? And everyone answers yes. Oh, it's ruder than it's ever been before. Right. And usually in these articles, they call back to a 50s TV show like Leave It to Beaver or Father's Knows Best and say, wish we could go back to those times. But I don't know about any of you, and as much as I find some cell phone users annoying, I wouldn't go back to the 50s for anything. That was a very bad time for a lot of people. It was a time of institutionalized racism in a lot of places, and where women were not quite treated as equal. I certainly wouldn't want to go back and be a gay man in the 1950s. So although manners, we have lost maybe some of the formal etiquette that was more common in those past eras, we have made a lot of gains too. And saying that our modern society is ruder now loses sight, I think, of some of those gains. That said, we have, in many cases, the 70s saw sort of a social revolution in the United States, obviously, and there are many cases where we sort of threw the baby out with the bathwater.
Indeed.
As far as etiquette, where we said that the old society was wrong, so everything about it must be wrong too. And I think that was the mistake. The fundamentals of good manners do not change. The forms change. The fundamentals are what's important, and fundamentals are about treating other people and your community with respect. The way you do that now is different from the way you did it in 1950, and the way you do it in San Francisco or New York is different from the way you do it in rural Minnesota or Vancouver, Canada. There are different ways of being polite. And I think a polite person, someone who wants to be polite, not only has to have a grounding and an understanding of what manners rules are, but also has to pay attention to context. You can't just pick a set of rules and then stick to them all the time. That's not being polite. Being polite is paying attention to other people and figuring out what is the polite thing to do in this situation. Shortly after the Roosevelts left the White House, Eleanor Roosevelt wrote a really lovely book on etiquette, and I'm going to misquote her, but at the very beginning she says something like, if ever you find that following a formal etiquette rule would be unkind, then throw out the rule and be kind instead, and that is good manners. And that's something I would like to instill that idea in people who are afraid of etiquette or think etiquette and manners is all, you know, teacups and doilies, because it isn't. Etiquette is the language we use to show respect for one another, and I think that's why it's important. And it's important for modern people and alternative press readers, because
I by no means accept the mainstream press
They do it too. And the other reason manners are important, I love to throw this in, and I'm going to misquote the writer Rita Mae Brown now. And she says, you can't be truly and effectively rude unless you understand what good manners are. And that's another really important thing, and it's not to be discounted, that if you treat everyone shabbily and disrespectfully, then what are you going to do with the people who deserve to be treated shabbily and disrespectfully? They're out there. If you start here, you have nowhere down to go. Being snubbed by someone who's a jerk doesn't bother you because the person's a jerk, but being snubbed by someone who everyone thinks is just a paragon of class and good manners, that really hurts.
Right. Well, it's a leveling off of the playing field. But you point out in the book, just to pursue for a second, that mention one of the other pet bugaboos along with the idea that there was some sort of mythical golden era in which every behavior was perfect, was the idea that telling someone noisily to turn off their cell phone when you're not in a private environment, when you're not at a play or a musical performance, but you're on a bus or something, while you might find that annoying, it doesn't necessarily make you less rude than the person who's doing it if you're on a bus or public transit.
That's very true. Telling someone that he or she is rude is in itself very rude. You don't correct someone's manners unless that person is your child, maybe your spouse or significant other, but even then you should tread very carefully, as many people have learned by experience. And I think there's an interesting problem of modern people, an interesting etiquette flaw, I think, in modern people, is the inability to differentiate between when they are being treated unjustly and when they are simply annoyed. When something is unjust, you may stand up and shout very loudly about it. But when you are simply annoyed, you have to sit there and be quiet. Sometimes other people are annoying, and that's just a fact of life. Hopefully the benefits of living among other people will outweigh that annoyance. It's when you're a hermit in rural Montana, it's very hard to find a good tailor. But and you're very right. When someone is being too loud on the bus, you put up with that because that's a problem of riding on the bus. When someone maybe is playing very loud music with bad words that children shouldn't be hearing, then maybe that is something you should ask the bus driver or some authority to step in. But you don't want to confront the person yourself usually because that person is obviously dangerously antisocial and getting into an argument is not going to benefit
dangerous,
anyone.
Dangerous, right.
Yeah. So, yes, I think that's an interesting point. People really do have to be aware of the difference between what is unjust and what is annoying. And other people can be annoying. The polite person just has to deal with that. Anyone can be polite when things are going great. But when things are going bad, that's the true test of your manners.
Well, I'm feeling a little like Sam Donaldson here, but I just want to pursue with one other question. What does one do? Perhaps you or Laura or any of the rest of you folks, if you're jumping in, Jeff, I want to get to your thoughts. But what do you do with the existential question of someone in the workplace who insists on talking in a loud tone of voice and broadcasting all of their personal information to the great annoyance of everyone else around them? And particularly when these people, when confronted, tend to get defensive and say, quote, everyone else is doing it, or there's nothing really wrong with it. Laura, you lecture folks or advise folks for a living, pardon me.
And I've been approached with that question far too many times, unfortunately, because most work environments are cubicle environments. Mm-hmm. And therefore, people are in fishbowls where they're sharing the airwaves with all their coworkers and forget the fact that voices travel. So my recommendation is, first of all, to try and remove oneself out of that area. If it's annoying you, as Charles was saying, try to deal with the annoyance by removing yourself, if you can, to a quiet place. If
that's not always possible over a sustained period.
Exactly.
Of time.
So if that isn't possible, if it's an ongoing situation, I believe in one-on-one communication. First of all, saying, I want you to know that I'm having a hard time dealing with my workload. Is there a way that you could lower the level of your voice or take that into a quiet room to make your phone call? If that doesn't work, then I believe going to the manager is the next step. I don't believe in suffering ad infinitum with somebody who should be adhering to group rules.
I agree with that. When someone is not following the rules, your recourse is to talk to someone in charge, find a manager or someone in personnel. If someone is playing by the rules but you're just annoyed by it, then maybe that's something for you to do a little bit of. I mean, I've had people write to me and ask questions. The person in the cubicle next to me sniffles or breathes too loud or types too aggressively.
Right. There are many things that people find annoying that are not necessarily
that's
rude.
Annoying. I say, if you can imagine your HR department issuing a memo forbidding this behavior, then you have a problem. If the idea of that sounds ridiculous, then the problem is yours internally to overcome.
Well, I just noticed that it's not uncommon in today's workplace that there are various people who've more and more people I've noticed are wearing earplugs in the workplace, which may be just that they prefer listening to their iPods, but there seem to be other explanations that are out there. Jeff, this would seem to speak to some of the questions that you deal with, how people perceive themselves as opposed to how they are perceived by others. And how does your sort of research play into the dissonance between those two perspectives?
Yeah, I mean, certainly people generally perceive themselves more favorably than they perceive others. So probably when you're doing the sniffling, you think that it's just normal behavior. And when someone else is doing it, you think that they're intentionally trying to, you know, screw up your workload. So, I mean, there are definitely, you know, self-enhancing biases in what we perceive. Mm-hmm. I actually wanted to return to what Charles was talking about and say, you know, the self-perception of how rude and polite people are also would not be any different today than it would be in any other time. And going back to think about the 1950s, in the 1950s, they were saying, I can't believe how badly things are. It wasn't like this in the 1920s. It wasn't like this in the 1910s.
Well, you know, I mean, just every to generation. Take issue, I agree that it's not unique to this era, but I agree with Charles's political points entirely. Perhaps it's just some the myth-building machine of the media, but, you know, I think one tends to think of the 50s apart from that, if you can subtract that large component of life, which includes social justice, racism, you know, and the various other aspects, as a somewhat more idyllic, at least less quickly paced time. I'm sorry?
It depends who you were.
Right. It does indeed.
But those are different questions.
Right.
One is the pace faster? And that has had certainly significant effects on what etiquette is. But nevertheless, at any place and any time, there is an etiquette.
Thanks.
And the etiquette is established by the people in that place and time interacting with one another. You know, people here and in the East Coast and in the Midwest and in Japan and in Europe are not biologically different. They're not biologically different from people in the 50s or the 20s. We're biologically the same. Whatever differences there are cultural differences. And so, you know, to say that people are somehow ruder is to say that norms have changed. That's really all you can say about it.
Well, I mean, I think it's perhaps like a Jane Austen truism that people who are consistently talking about other people's rudeness are people... Let's try that on you. Who tend to be more rude themselves? Would that seem applicable, or
I don't know
if that's too general?
I don't know if that's true or not. I'm not sure. But you know, I think it is likely that the rate of technology forces changes in etiquette, and I think the rate of technological change in recent years has picked up probably a lot.
So it might have changed the etiquette, but not altered the rules.
Yeah, and it may have accelerated the rate at which etiquette has changed in the last 30 years compared to, say, between the 1920s and 1950s. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of etiquette has to do with communication and interacting with other people, and the advent of laptop computers and cell phones and all this has really changed all of that. And I think society in a lot of ways is still coming to grips with what the etiquette ought to be. And so I think what you see now is you see a sort of clash sometimes of different ideals or ideas of what the etiquette ought to be. And
what people are saying about rap music today, is, to go back to Charles's point, is not that different from what I heard about Elvis Presley or whatever growing up. Beatles, you know, it seems to be... Well, to get back to the question of people's lives that many seem to care most, Trish, what are the new rules for finding? I mean, I think this sort of relates to how technology affects the intimate relationships. Has it altered the dynamic, or are they still? Is it still the same dynamic, but just with more immediate access because of the internet?
Well, from my perspective, I would say that it has confused the dynamic. I remember in the early days of online dating, maybe 1996, a woman writing to me and saying, I wrote a dating advice column, and her question was that she had a rule that she never slept with a man until she had had 5 dates with him, and that was just her personal rule, and seemed like, you know, a fine rule for her. And she had exchanged 3 emails with a man and then had a telephone conversation with him, and they had agreed to have a date. And in the course of exchanging those 3 emails, she had explained her rule to him. And so she was very surprised at the end of the first date when he expected to go home with her and have sex with her. And he explained to her that, you know, these were the modern days, and they had had 5 interactions. Uh-huh. 3 of them through email and 1 of them over the phone. And
Did her rules about going home with him include a moratorium on online sex and until the 5 were up?
I'm not sure about that one. That said, I think that something resonates with me, which is this idea of everyone is doing it, right? And we do a lot of research about etiquette and behaviors in terms of online dating, things like breaking up online. Like, is it okay if you've been face-to-face on a date with someone? And actually, one of y'all raise your hand, and I'd be curious to see how many of you think it's okay in some situations to break up with someone via email? you know, 10 hands in the room, right? So that means most of you don't think it's okay yet. But what you'll start hearing people say is, well, everyone else is doing it. We just did some research, and we found that just about 50% of singles who are using online dating services think that it's okay to ignore an email from someone who's written a nicely composed email simply because you're not attracted to the person, because everyone's doing it. So I think what's going on right now, or there are no real rules that have completely evolved in terms of the technology of love. These are certainly not things that our parents sit us down and tell us, like, it's not okay to break up via email, because they don't have a clue, right? They haven't done it. And so we are inventing these rules, and, you know, for the most part, I think we're getting it right, although I think there's probably room for improvement.
Well, just to play the contrarian again, Steph, what is wrong about... I hear what you're saying about breaking up with someone online, but in terms of non-response, Charles has also gotten this into his book about the protocol of whether or not one should acknowledge when one's approached by a homeless person in the street, not uncommon. And perhaps my experience is jaundiced by what I do for a living, but if I had to respond to every publicist, for instance, who approaches me about a random story idea, then I would be doing nothing in my life but that. So it seems to me that perhaps in the social contract you do have the freedom to respond or not respond based on whether or not you find the person attractive, let's say.
Well, and I would just add one thing is that it's actually more complicated than that because, you know, think about the 25-year-old woman in her online dating profile who says she's like she'd like to meet men 30 and under. And then the 50-year-old man who writes to her anyway because he knows in his case she's going to make an exception because once she sees his photo or reads about, you know, what a stellar human being he is, everything she actually said that mattered to her will no longer matter to her. And this, of course, happens a lot in online dating. It's kid in the candy store, and wildly unrealistic expectations are, you know, encouraged and fostered on these sites. So in that instance, you might say, well, gee, you know, that woman shouldn't have to write to every 55-year-old man who writes to her and disregards everything she says about, you know, what's meaningful or important to her in terms of a romantic partner. And so we become socialized. So, and I'm not picking on men, believe me, although it's fun to do sometimes in dating. But, you know, these men become socialized to not expect a response because they're sending out all of these emails. Or what about the form emails that, you know, seem like a very personal email until I find out that my best friends both got the same email the same day from this guy. So, you know, there's situations where people are behaving badly, and in fact, it's probably appropriate not to respond. But unfortunately, I think a lot of people who write nice emails and take the time to be sincere also don't hear back from people.
Well, I just would mention, I've been asked to mention, by the way, that we're going to take questions from you folks in about 5 minutes, and there'll be mics in the aisle to line up. It sounds like some of the folks wanted to jump in.
I wanted to agree with Trish that in some cases it does make sense not to respond to an email in that situation. And people talk a lot about new technologies changing the way we communicate, and nobody knows how to use these new technologies properly. The basic rules, though, have not really changed, although the media have changed, the different medium, the medium that you might use to communicate changes. So to use Trish's example, the online dating world, when someone approaches you in a good faith effort to make your acquaintance because you have sparked some romantic interest in them, the polite thing to do is, if you're not interested, to say no thank you. But when a creep harasses you, you have every right to give him the cold shoulder and, you know, send him on his way without a word. That is true in the real world, and
you
it's
say the
true
same thing at a bar, let's say,
world.
If someone comes
yeah.
up and wants to buy you a drink.
Exactly.
Uh-huh.
And if someone is aggressive and rude uh-huh. and is not taking your hints, that your no hints, then you can ignore that person or maybe have him beaten up by the bouncer. But if someone is playing by the rules and approaching you because they think you might be interested in him or what have you, I haven't done a lot of online dating, but from what I understand, a form email takes about 2 seconds to send, and there's nothing impolite about saying, I don't think we're a good match, but good luck to you, and thanks for your note. You know?
Well, I have noticed that people in that experience tend to escalate. Jeff?
Yeah, but at the same time, people are much more able to contact you now than they once were. Mm-hmm. In the old days, someone approaching you for a date right. had to know you, and they had to lay the groundwork, and they right. had to personally look you in the eye and ask you. And it's just so easy now to send people requests. If I responded to every quest, right. request I got from a student, a potential student who was thinking about coming and wanted to know about my research, I get 12 of those a day. You know, and you can't
You're
respond.
Lucky.
You can't right. Well, that's just right. that's just the students, the right. publishers, the editors. It's nonstop. You know,
I've got family members who are in faculty, and they get constant emails from students who are asking them for help about things yeah. that were covered in the classroom.
Students will approach you at rates and in ways that they never would have in the past because it's just become much easier to do. And so it's not surprising to me that the rules for disengaging have also changed because you need different strategies. Maybe it's only 5 seconds to respond to one, mm-hmm. but to respond to 200 of them, you know, suddenly you're out an hour or two.
Well, we live in, I don't know that this is different than any previous age, but we do live in an age of stalkers. And, once a polite no can be taken by people who don't have boundaries as a sign of encouragement. And I guess I would just argue, maybe for the sake of ordinariness, that just because we live in an age of instant communication does not mean that we're obliged to instantly communicate. I don't know. And there are other questions which, I know that you've come up with, faced with, Trish, in your work, of where people game the system. I mean, there's certainly take on different identities and whether or not there's a Web 3.0 perfect solution to that. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Well, just quickly, I think that, there's gaming the system and gaming the system. And it is amazing to me what people have done on online dating services to just make the odds slightly better. For instance, some services, if you go and change your profile, it moves you higher up in the viewing list. And so people will go in every day and make very minor little changes about, they'll put an instead of a the or something and, games their way back into the system. But I think, more sinisterly, that to a certain extent, there are attributes that most people find attractive. And most of us know that. In fact, Stephen Levitt, in his book Freakonomics, he looked at online dating services, and he said some interesting thing, like, surprisingly, from a statistical perspective, there are a lot more blondes on online dating services than there are in the world, in general, statistically. And men make a lot more money, and women are thinner and younger. So, for instance, a man on an online dating service who says he's looking for a serious relationship or marriage will get a lot more responses.
Or who says that he himself is single.
Exactly. will get a lot
Unheard
more responses
of,
than a man who says he's looking to date very casually. And so, the systems themselves are these big warehouses that seem to be encouraging people to just say what makes them popular in terms of going on a date. Of course, once you get on the date and truth comes out, then these dates are very unsuccessful. And just quickly, there was a piece of research that said only 28% of the users, this is actually Jupiter research, 28% of the users of leading online dating services in 2005 reported a satisfactory experience on the site. So as an industry, I think we have some big challenges to get people to more success. And I think part of more success is to get people to tell the truth and be nice and respond to emails. And so that the experience is generally a good experience, even if you don't fall in love.
Well, I'm retired from that whole end of thing, as Bill Clinton once said, but in my case, accurately. In any case, I think we should... I'm told that this is the time when you folks who've been nice enough to come out here in a stormy night... get a chance to ask your questions. And the microphones are over there.
Regarding online dating, Trish, you mentioned that, sometimes people aren't altogether honest about who they are or what they are. How is that different than the past? Say Shakespeare's All Fair in Love and War.
Right. Well, not a lot different, although I think it's easier to be dishonest online because there are no social checks and balances. And so in the offline world, you have something called a reputation. And that reputation follows you. It's the little whispers. It's the people who vouch for you or who aren't willing to vouch for you. It's the social community that looks at your behavior and frowns upon it or smiles upon it. And that tells me something about you. And sadly, on most online dating services, the only thing I know about you is what you tell me. And often what you tell me is what you think you need to tell me so that I will date you. So I don't think it's changed all that much. I mean, there's always been an incentive in dating to not necessarily tell the truth. We call them little white lies. I think that just there are a lot more lying going on online right now.
Well, I'd like to show you my 4-carat ring that I got from a match.com. Oh. And my significant other told the truth. You? Yeah. Mine's 4 years old, and it was wonderful. I mean, just fabulous, just a meeting of the minds and so forth. And it's true that I found him compassionate, lovely, honest, and happened to be gorgeous as far as I was concerned. That was just a bonus. My second question is about business. I'm a realtor, and I'm a little long in the tooth here, but I've been in the business about 18 years. And one of the things that I'd like to ask you, Laura, is thanking people for their business, doing it by email or written note. That's one thing that I would be really curious what the mores of today are. And the second thing is dressing for success. I mean, in Berkeley, we dress pretty casually, but a little more like this, you know. What do you think makes the best first impression?
Thank you. Those are questions that I'm asked frequently. Thanking people never goes out of style. So apropos of what Jeff was saying, it is something that we all need to do more often, I believe. And especially in a business environment, it's critical to express those thanks quickly, to not let too much time pass. I'm a firm believer in a handwritten note, especially nowadays, where I believe it's a dying art form. I think receiving a handwritten note says that you've taken the time to put pen in hand and put those thoughts on paper, which most of us don't do these days. So that automatically separates you from 99% of the population. However, in this day of technology, I also believe an email thank you is appropriate in many occasions, especially if you're writing to a group of people that you've met with that day, or if it's a more casual thank you, if you've gone out for lunch with somebody and it hasn't been a major event, a quick email to say how much you enjoyed their company is appropriate. But if you have the time, and if it doesn't seem overblown, I would always vote for a handwritten note. Dressing for success is a topic that we've talked about for a long time, and it's just changing all the time, as is our language, as are our mores. And I think what's most important is dressing apropos to your environment. So if you're a realtor in Berkeley, it makes sense to not wear long white gloves and a tiara, because you'll look like a fool. And most important, you want to make those around you feel comfortable. So if you're dressed similarly, those people around you will feel more relaxed and more comfortable. But my recommendation is always that you dress at the top of that level of people that you're going to be with. So if you're with people who tend to dress more casually, then I would dress to the top of that casual level. That might mean wearing a jacket and slacks with a blouse instead of wearing a skirt. But it also might mean, in Berkeley, wearing Birkenstocks, and that's okay. So it really matters who you're with, what will make them comfortable, as well as what you will feel comfortable in.
Sir.
So my question to the panel was on the concept of building a professional identity. So going to school at Berkeley and going through a lot of the professional organizations I did when I was going to Berkeley, it was drilled into my head that first impressions are absolutely crucial. And when I'm in business, I should be as professional as possible. So I started developing this professional identity. And so in terms of the way I dressed was incredibly formal or professional. And it worked well for the first two or three years when I was in a marketing organization at a tech company. Now, ironically, now I'm in the sales arm of the tech company. And I've been told, well, I dress a little too formally, actually, sometimes. And actually, people can tell that I'm very professional, but that may not be who I really am. Because it's true. Because if I'm out on, let's say, Zeitgeist in the Mission, which is a bar on Sunday afternoon, I'm certainly not wearing a suit. I'm most likely wearing jeans or something like more like hipster style. So now when I'm actually talking in front of a customer and I'm saying, yes, Mr. or Mrs. Customer, and I'm talking in a very formal attitude, and now I'm told to be much more conversational, obviously it's kind of difficult sometimes to kind of reconcile both of these different identities. So I have the professional, very politically correct, very straightforward, very to the numbers personality, and my real outside personality is much more this gregarious, outgoing, I don't give a crap what I say kind of attitude. So being a professional young man in an organization where I'm expected to be both professional but at the same time completely casual, sometimes in work clothes as well as attitude, how am I, as a young man, growing into a professional organization, supposed to reconcile these two?
Well, there's medication for these kind of questions, I mean, I think that if you're... I'll leave it to the panel, but perhaps if there's... if you're looking for seed money in a VC, what was the story that Gates had to borrow a tie at the airport when he was first getting Microsoft going? But what are the thoughts from the group? I'm just messing around here.
Well, I think that everybody has several different personas that they put on in different situations. I'm not the same person I am with my mother as I am with my friends, as I am with people I work with. I'm very different people in all those circumstances. And I think that this kind of goes back to something I said earlier, that choosing a set of formal manners and saying this is the right thing to do in every situation is a bad tack to take. I think certainly someone starting out in a profession would be wise to take the advice of his peers and his managers, and if his attitude is too formal, then to take it down a notch. If I, if I get a job, I have worked at in technology publishing here in San Francisco, and if I go to work in a jacket and tie and insist on calling my boss Ms. Smith or Mr. Gomez, people are going to think I'm crazy, and I'm not going to get promoted, and no one's going to like me at work. And I think that, and so I'll put on a sweater and jeans and wear tennis shoes to work. And I think that's a valuable lesson for anybody hoping to advance in his career, is not only that you have to understand what good manners are and understand formal, but also know when to apply them. And anyone, for me, and I think for a lot of modern people, that idea is very familiar because we have to change the way we behave quite a bit. So I think that insisting on formal manners in an environment where they have been questioned is a bad tack to take. You may think makes more sense to call your boss Ms. Smith. I do, certainly. But Ms. Smith has let it be known that she prefers to be called Liz, and so I'm going to call her Liz. I think that's just doing your job well.
Hi. I guess this question is particularly directed to Trish and to Jeff. I found the conversation about, lying online very interesting. And it's very easy to lie, or alternatively to tell the truth about one's age, one's weight, one's hair color. But there's a limit, and that has to do with how one perceives oneself. I mean, for example, I could say in an ad, I'm shy. However, others around me may not perceive me as being shy, so I just like your thoughts on, going up against those limits other than knowing thyself.
When I first started working in the dating industry, I worked in the offline matchmaking industry where people would come and pay several thousand dollars to hire a matchmaker, and very sincere people looking for long-term relationships, really committing to the process. And we had something called a feedback procedure where after you had been on three or four dates, we would sort of use the collective intelligence concept and talk to all your dates and make a little report and talk to you about how you were being perceived and how you were succeeding and ways you might improve. And what's so interesting to us was that the people who were just notoriously awful daters never asked for feedback. It was the people who really had it together, who were behaving well, who they might not have fallen in love, but people thought they were nice and interesting and appropriate, who always wanted to be better and better. So I guess part of what I'm saying is that I do think that we are sometimes disconnected to how the world perceives us and how we see ourselves. I think the way people get in trouble with online dating is sometimes just too much information, telling way too much about yourself in your profile. And I think services get in trouble in this way too, in that they give you so much criteria to choose your next romantic partner. Does it really matter if the love of your life has blue eyes or brown eyes? I mean, really very trivial criteria that probably shouldn't be part of that dating process, but we feel this very strong need to be loved for who we are. And in order for someone to know us, we really want to tell them a lot of things, but probably too many things. So generally, in terms of dating online, in creating a profile, starting to exchange email with people, I always say to just take it very lightly. You know, let the mystery of who you are be revealed over time, and just tell a little bit of your life story, just enough to keep somebody hanging on and interested in more.
Well, maybe in the same spirit that you don't get into your messy divorce on the offline the first day. Jeff, you look, you had some thoughts.
Yeah, so, you know, the danger with misrepresenting yourself online, of course, is if the relationship continues and thrives sooner or later, you know, and you're found out right away if you're 50 pounds heavier than you say you are. You know, with traits, it's much more difficult. Something like shy, you know, it's hard to judge the accuracy of those things. And in that case, you know, it really does benefit you to have good self-insight and to know yourself well. If you misrepresent yourself, and I don't mean misrepresent in an intentional way, mm-hmm. I mean just it turns out that who you think you are is wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, that turns out not to be very good. People do like others to see them the way that they see themselves, mm-hmm. and so much so that people who have low self-esteem and are depressed prefer roommates and partners who have negative views of them than people who have more positive views of them. People like to have their self-images verified by the people around them. And so not knowing yourself, even if you're trying to be honest, could be a real hazard in terms of getting a poor match.
Again, a good case for medication. Further.
Can I just add one quick thing? One of the things that we've discovered in terms of online dating is your friends have bragging rights about you that you don't have about yourself. So in my profile, if I said, you know, I'm fabulous and smart and great looking, you know, that really doesn't sound very attractive. But get your friends to write something about you, because they can really fill in the blanks about who you are with some great flair and color.
I have one very brief question, and it's more about the business etiquette. I want to know business etiquette within emails. My emails to my friends have no capital letters, no paragraph spacing, and that's become a little bit more accepted, I see, within internal business emails. Is that true?
I think it depends on your business environment. Just as flaming emails are accepted in some business environments and are not in others. And for those who don't know what a flaming email is, it's when one uses foul language or dresses somebody down unnecessarily. Sometimes necessarily, but usually it's a very angry email. And in some business cultures, that's the norm. But I would say it can be a slippery slope, because if you get in the habit with your friends of not using capitalization, of not spell checking, of not using introductions and salutations, then you run the risk of starting to do that in more formal environments. And I know many people in my world who look at an email like that and say, they didn't care enough to use a capital I for the word I. Ding! They didn't care enough to use spell check or to use a salutation. And for better or for worse, that creates a negative impression. So my suggestion always is to get in the habit. I know it takes more time. Get in the habit of using the kind of grammar you would use if you were to write a note.
But it does change, does it not, between the application and when you are in the actual workforce, when this thing, the kind of communication has become so endemic that it's mm-hmm. almost impossible to prevent.
It's a challenge. I absolutely agree.
Sir?
I guess the focus has been mostly on And it obviously is more interesting to talk about like horizontal relationships between a man and a woman. I was just curious about vertical relationships, how to develop warm and almost cozy relationship with your boss, perhaps. Well, not cozy in that sense, but
I'm vertically cozy.
Friendly and comfortable is what I mean.
You know, actually, I don't know. When people talk to me about their professional relationships, I tend to recommend not getting too cozy at all and not turning those relationships into friendships just because you work together. If a natural friendship develops because you happen to work with someone with whom you share interests and so on, that, of course, you know, that's great. But I think that many modern companies try to instill a friendly feeling and a family feeling in their employees, to think of their peers at work as pals. And I think that often that can lead to dangerous and inappropriate behavior. I think it's often safer to treat your coworkers as coworkers and not to treat them as friends. Unless you develop a friendship outside of work. And the danger with becoming cozy with your boss and becoming friendly with your boss is that maybe other people aren't friendly with your boss and they're going to look at you and say, why is it known to happen. Yeah. So I don't know. As far as the workplace, I tend to suggest when people ask me things like that to keep things as professional as possible in the workplace. I don't know if Laura.
I would like to add something to that because I think that has value. I also think there's something called the likability factor, which you mentioned earlier, Trish. And one of my favorite recent books is called The Likability Factor by Tim Sanders. And it deals with how people relate to us, specifically in business environments, but I think it crosses the board into social situations as well. And one of his premises is that the thing that creates a sense of likability and people wanting to be around us and to enjoy our company is not whether we're smart or funny or interesting or engaging, but how we make that other person feel when they leave our presence. And so if your boss leaves your cubicle and thinks, gosh, that was a great conversation, I really enjoyed that, chances are it's because you've made him feel smart, interesting, valuable, and have created a sense of worth about himself. And I think if it's done in a genuine way rather than just glad-handing and schmoozing, I think that has value and creates relationship on an honest level.
Jeff, you look like you're
just saying, be very careful. Like she was saying, if you get caught and it seems like glad-handing, that's really bad.
It is indeed. Yeah. I can't stand that kind of smarmy.
Yes.
Who was the fellow on Charles. Leave It to Beaver?
Say what? Eddie Haskell.
Eddie Haskell, yes.
Right. Or if the boss leaves, you might find yourselves in an interesting position when the person who did not enjoy that relationship
becomes your boss.
Right.
The best way to get a good reputation at work is to do your job really well. That's what I would suggest. Not to try to be the most well liked.
I was struck, Trish, by the fact that you referred to the dating industry a couple of times, and it reminded me of my my best friend, who's now bent on as many first dates as she can possibly have because she's quite convinced that it's a numbers game, that meeting Mr. Right is a numbers game. And so I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about that kind of industrialization of dating and any ideas about where you see it heading.
You know, I think when online dating started, the beauty of it was that it brought access to single people. Suddenly I had access to 50 or 50,000 or 500,000 attractive men who had college degrees and, you know, collected baseball cards. I don't know, whatever was interesting to me, right? There was it opened up doors for people. But in many ways, I think these huge sites, and they boast their numbers, and there is a competition of numbers right now in the dating category, have sort of stripped dating of the quiet, calm nuances that make it so spectacular? And, you know, I talk to people and I say, where do you want to meet the love of your life? Is it at a rave at Madison Square Garden? Or is it at a cocktail party at your best friend's house? That bigger is not necessarily better. And this more mentality around dating has really caused some behaviors that I think are very negative. This sense that, you know, there's always someone else. Ah, you know, whatever, I'll blow this guy off because I've got 6 more emails in my inbox right now from other baseball collecting tall, dark, and handsome men. And I don't think that's a good thing, because we're treating people like merchandise and, you know, like blue jeans, where there's just always more and more. And everyone isn't doing it, though. And I think the opportunity that online dating has created is overwhelming to some people. And I think it takes some maturity to manage that opportunity in a dignified way.
I think we may have time for one more question. Are we up? We're up. Listen, I apologize, but you're certainly welcome to chat with the panelists.
Can I just say one-liner?
Yes. I'll break the rule.
I met and married my soulmate from Match.com 7 years ago. That's when I first met you, Trish, Catherine Winter, and I cannot say enough positive things about it, because it's, as you said, that there are, you know, a lot of ways to meet people, but if you really want to meet people and read about them and go through some numbers, I think people will have a great success.
Well, a nice way to end the discussion. Please join me in giving a big hand to the panelists. And thanks to all of you for coming out. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club's Inforum is adjourned.